morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our courtroom, and we have some special guests today from Union Grove High School. Would they please stand so we can welcome them? Good, thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a cleverly entitled program called Court with Class. We invite students from across the state to come to the courtroom and listen to an oral argument. And then the students are invited to stay after this second argument and meet with the justice assigned for the day, and the discussion is on the procedures of the court. How we take a case, how we decide a case, how we write opinions and then mandate the opinions. And everyone is invited to attend that session after lunch. And this is a program that has been long sponsored by not only this court, but by the State Bar of Wisconsin. If anyone needs a summary of the case we're about to hear, just raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. On my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and Justice Bradley is the justice assigned to meet with the students today. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crux, and next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far right is Justice Michael Gableman. Having introduced the court and having met you students too, I'll call our second case, which is 12AP2170, State versus Joseph J. Spaeth. Arguing on behalf of the court is Assistant Attorney General Warren D. Weinstein.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Warren D. Weinstein. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Your voice is a little low. It might help if you move the microphone closer to you or you raise the podium.
How's that?
That's much better. Thank you.
I'll try to lean in.
All right. Lean in.
Oh, aren't you clever?
In 2006, the legislature undertook a major rework of Chapter 980, the legislation for civil commitment of sexually violent persons. As it affects this case, the legislature did two important things. First, it reduced the allegations in the petition from four separate allegations to three. And second of all, it changed the state's proof requirement at trial from the allegations in the petition to whether or not the respondent was a sexually violent person. The original statute, in four separate paragraphs, set out conditions or requirements of allegations in the petition, and those were that the person had been convicted of a sexually violent offense. There were a couple alternatives that don't apply to this case. The second was that the person was within 90 days of release or discharge from a sentence imposed for a sexually violent offense. The third was that the person have a mental disorder, and the fourth was that the person be dangerous. The legislature completely removed the second of those, which is the requirement that the person be within 90 days of release from a sexually violent offense.
Now, it could be a day before, right?
It could. Or in some instances, like in Carpenter, even after a recalculated time.
Right. Mm-hmm. And going back in. Okay.
Right. The legislature did retain one timing aspect, which I will characterize as a condition precedent. It required that the petition be filed before release or discharge. That's new language in a separate subsection. It does not have any qualifying language in it, and it no longer must be alleged nor approved.
Now, that's 1M, just so we all stay on the same page.
It is
980.021M. A petition filed under this section, which is 980.02, shall be filed before the person is released or discharged, period. Okay?
Correct.
That's a key provision for you.
That is.
And for Mr. Spaeth.
That's right.
Okay.
In this case, the problem occurred because the allegations of the petition when it was filed were for Mr. Spaeth's, what we call the 2006, I believe it is, convictions. Which
offense number two. Why don't we call
case
it
number
offense
two.
Number two? Okay.
Right. Case number two,
okay.
Which was the subject of one of this court's opinions on the criminal side, which held that some statements he made were violative of the Fifth Amendment.
And were to be suppressed.
And on remand, the state lacked evidence of the offenses and dismissed the case.
So what you have is a complaint filed when he is in prison, right, before his release.
That's right.
And it has as its allegation that offense number two.
Correct.
All right.
In response, Mr. Spaeth moved to dismiss the complaint, the petition, and the state moved to amend the complaint to add sexually violent conviction number one, which had occurred in 1992.
Right, and he's not on any paper on that anymore.
He's fully discharged from that offense prior to the filing of the petition and prior to his release.
Mm-hmm.
The original statute did not require, although I think as a matter of practice, it always was the case, that the sexually violent offense provided in paragraph A and the sentence imposed for a sexually violent offense in section AG, the statute didn't require those to be the same offense. But as a matter of practice, that was the easiest way to allege the petition. Since you had to prove it anyway.
Now, what do you have to prove?
Well, under the original statute, you had to prove that the person had been convicted of a sexually violent offense, and that they were within 90 days of release from a sexually violent offense, or, as it developed under the case law, a term of imprisonment of which sexually violent offense was a part.
That's right. Parole revocation or concurrent or consecutive sentences, that's what you're referring to, right?
Right.
Villiers and Carpenter and Treadway, that series of cases.
That's
right.
Correct.
All right.
But the statute did not require the allegation of what came to be known through court decisions as the predicate offense to be the one alleged under sub A. It just was the easiest thing to do because you had to prove the conviction from which the person was, or the term from which the person was released anyway. So when the legislature removed that, the question now becomes whether or not, if the person has been convicted of more than one offense, is the state obliged to allege a particular sexually violent offense?
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Suppose we have the same fact situation, at least up to the second offense. So he's got a sexually violent offense. He's paid his price. He's off paper. He is now in prison for tax evasion. And in the first offense, apparently they didn't charge him as a 980, right?
No, there was not a petition filed prior to his parole. I guess it was parole.
And they,
it's old enough.
I gathered they could have.
Well,
I mean, we had the Chapter 980 was in effect, right?
Yes.
I don't know why.
We would have to make some assumptions about why they didn't, but it was at least possible.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Because you're assuming now that it's a sexually violent offense under the statute you can charge. I mean, that's your premise.
There's no question it is.
Right. Okay. So now he's in for tax fraud, and you relook at his whole background, and you think, well, we should have really gotten him, which is what you're thinking now, on the first one. Can you do that?
I think under the language of the statute, the answer is yes.
That's what I wanted to know, because it shouldn't matter that the second offense, which is vacated and gone, right?
Right.
That the second offense was a sexual offense that was on the statute. I assume enticement would come under the statute, too. So even if it was tax evasion or some other felony, carrying a gun as a felon, former felon, or whatever, that your position would be, let's see, that was in 1993, wasn't that the first offense?
That was when the conviction was. I think the offense actually occurred in 92.
Okay, so 93. So now it's 2013. So that's 20 years ago. And so the state's position is they can look at a sexual offense 20 years old. He's in prison for some other matter, and I'm going to make it totally different because it's just an easier example. Totally different. The state can go back now and say, as a result of that 20-year sexual offense, we can apply 980. You might not win, but you want to apply it, right? Is that your position?
That under the language of the statute, yes. There are, I think, two safeguards may be a little bit too strong of a word, but there are two practical reasons why that's unlikely to happen. The first is that the notice requirement, which speaks not to the petition nor to the prosecutors, but to the person under the language of the statute having jurisdiction, in other words, the custodian, that
the number of that statute?
That's 980-015. I think the numbering is still the same. It was 015 under the old statute.
Oh, let's see. 980.015. That's the notice statute to the Department of Justice and to the DA?
No. That's the notice. Well, I'm sorry.
That is notice.
It's directed to the Department of Corrections or the Department of Health and Social or the Department of Health. The notice goes to the Department of Justice.
Okay, we're
or
in the same statute.
But,
sure. That's where the notice goes.
But
right.
But the duty is on corrections.
Right. Got it.
And they're not required, or they, I guess, arguably can't, but certainly the statute gives them the duty to make a referral for someone who's about to be released for a sexually violent offense still. And they would have to believe, from the statutory language, that the person might meet qualifications. Mm-hmm. And that also encompasses the second safeguard, if you will.
Well, and the defendant relies on that statute.
Right, they do. At least the proximity of it.
That's right. And saying, hey, that tells you that what you're trying to do, that's what their position is. Your position is that they may be a little right because you're saying it's a safeguard against my tax defrauder.
Well, the safeguard is that you still have to demonstrate that the person has a current mental disorder and is currently dangerous.
Sure.
So 20 years later, maybe that old sexually violent offense
I know,
isn't going to get you there.
But you still want, the state still can still put the person through that task.
That's correct. And I would say, why shouldn't that be the case in a situation where, as it with Mr. Spaeth, he has admitted to recent sexual violence against children? So it's not like we're saying, oh, this guy had a sexually violent offense 20 years ago and he's been fine ever since, and we want to put him through a trial on whether or not he's dangerous. It's that he's admitted behavior that indicates that the problem that existed 20 years ago when he had that sexually violent offense still exists today. And it seems to me that that was the intent of the legislature to begin with. I think the language in the within 90 days was a way to narrow, to some extent, the persons to whom the statute applied. But apparently the legislature has decided that those restrictions need not apply any longer because they removed the statute, the language.
Now, the defendant relies a lot on the Gilbert case, where the court read 1M to say, is released or discharged, shall be found before released or discharged, held under the predicate offense.
They do.
Yeah. How do you get rid of that?
Well, of course, the issue in the Gilbert case didn't have anything to do with that subsection. That's the first thing. I think the opinion itself was picking up from some of the older case law, but nevertheless, even if you were to interpret the language under that way, I don't think it aids Mr. Spaeth, because at the time that the state filed its petition, he was in custody on a sexually violent offense, which had not yet been reversed. And as this court said very early on in Carpenter, the timing aspect that the state was required to allege is, in effect, a snapshot of the facts at the time that the state files the petition. When the state filed the petition in this case, Mr. Spaeth had those child enticement convictions, and they had not yet been reversed. So under Carpenter, Mr. Spaeth meets the requirement for the timing aspect of the filing of the petition under Carpenter, even if one interprets 1M to mean release or discharge from a sexually violent offense. But I think that what that does is it adds language that the legislature either repealed, if you believe 1M was enacted to replace 2AG, or didn't add to a new section if you buy Mr. Spaeth's view that 1M stemmed from this other problem with DA. In either event, Mr. Spaeth is arguing that language that's no longer there should nonetheless control. And it seems to me that asking the court really not to interpret the statute, but to amend it, because Mr. Spaeth wants language added that the legislature didn't add. So I think that's a major problem with his view of how the statute should be interpreted. But either way, I think the circuit court erred in this case, because it viewed both the allegation of being convicted of a sexually violent offense and the timing of the filing of the petition as intertwined or connected, when in fact they aren't and never have been, really.
Under some case law, they have been, even if it hasn't been in the words of the statute. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so the case law interpreting the statute
has generally, although that's never come up as an issue, yeah, the case law has certainly, if not stated directly, has strongly indicated that.
That goes hand in glove with your argument of where did that language come from in the Gilbert, that sentence regarding 1M?
Right, that's
it
right.
It came from the old case law that interpreted.
Right, but it wasn't at issue in Gilbert because that didn't involve the timing of the filing of the petition. It involved the dismissal based on subsequent offenses, which we don't have here.
Justice Presser.
Does the petition ultimately have to be amended for you to prevail?
I don't know that it does. The reason that the state moved to amend is because of the requirement in sub 2A, which requires the petition to allege a sexually violent offense.
2A1, right?
It's 980.2A now under the new statute.
One. Person has been convicted.
In this case, it's one, yes.
Yes.
But I think the state can meet that requirement by merely alleging Mr. Spaeth has been convicted of a sexually violent offense because we're a notice pleading state. And that certainly gives him notice of what he has to defend. If the state had pled more generally, Mr. Spaeth has been convicted of a sexually violent offense, then no, the petition would not have had to been amended because it would just be a matter of whether or not the state can prove that Mr. Spaeth has been convicted of a sexually violent offense, which he can.
One thing that sort of troubles me here, having written the first Spaeth opinion, as I recall, six members of the court basically said that all of the evidence against the defendant came out of essentially a forced confession in a situation with talking with a parole officer.
Correct.
And as a result, and even the parole officer said, you can't do anything with this.
Well, yeah, that was on the form, certainly. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think they advised the police in Oshkosh, you're not supposed to question him. You can revoke his parole, yeah. Okay. But essentially the case said you can't take advantage of a violation of the Fifth Amendment to prosecute the person criminally. Well, that's what the state did. They took advantage of that improperly obtained admission to provide the very conviction that you're depending on. I can look at the plain language of the statute and say, well, he was convicted. He was convicted in 2006 for a sexually violent offense. Let's move on. But there's something so inherently unfair about that. Now, how do you deal with that?
I think in two ways. One is that, first of all, the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply to the civil cases, and it's always been the case that a coerced, if you will, confession on the criminal side could be used to, in a civil case, for whatever purpose, the most obvious one being parole revocation. And Minnesota versus Murphy holds that even though you can't prosecute this guy, you can revoke his parole because that's a civil proceeding. Well, this is a civil proceeding also. And second of all, while it's true you can't convict him of a criminal offense, he certainly admitted to the offense, to the dangerous acts. And the purpose of this statute isn't to punish him for the crime. It's to segregate him from society, for one thing, and treat his underlying mental disorder as another. So the purposes of the statutes are different. The law that controls the admissibility of the statements is different. And also, there's the problem that the state would still have to prove that he's dangerous on the date of the trial versus in 1992 when his sexual assault occurred.
But isn't the subject of a 980 proceeding entitled to all of the rights that a criminal defendant would have?
Not anymore.
Not anymore?
No. That was a statutory provision, and the statutory provision has been repealed.
I'm a little confused. I'm sorry. The question that Justice Prosser asked was, do you have to amend the petition? Right? Now,
right.
And your answer is no. That's what I thought you said.
Well, I'm...
But you can't say that.
I think it would I think whether or not you have to amend the petition depends on how you pleaded in the initials.
Okay.
And the way it was pled this way, in this case, the answer is yes.
But you would have to ultimately rely on the offense for the first offense.
To prove him to be sexually violent, that's
You'd
correct.
Have to, that's right. And subsection 3 says a petition filed under this section shall state with particularity essential facts to establish probable cause to believe he's violent. If the petition alleges a sexually violent offense or act that is the basis of the allegation under 2A, which is he's been convicted of a sexually violent act, then you have to state the grounds on which the offense or act is alleged to be sexually motivated. So you are going to have to, your petition, if it didn't have particularity, isn't any good under this section.
Well, you...
If it's so loose, it's not any good. So ultimately, you are going to have to amend this, either by a motion to amend or bringing in evidence and then saying the evidence by being admitted in effect amends the petition, which is a standard concept in civil law, right?
Well, I disagree with you in
part.
At least two regards.
Okay.
First,
that's pretty good.
First is the sexual motivation has nothing to do with this case,
okay,
because sexual motivation is used in the statute to mean a crime that is not defined as a sexually violent offense, but may be a sexually violent offense because it's sexually motivated, i.e. burglary, robbery, some crime like that.
Okay, so you think you're only
setting
under
that
the first
that
sentence.
Wasn't your main point,
no.
Setting that aside.
Right. Good try.
What subsection 3 means, in my view, is the state cannot allege nor rely solely upon a sexually violent offense conviction. And the allegations of the petition in this case don't rely solely on either the 2006 or the 1992 conviction, because it also alleges that psychological individual people believe that this person has a mental disorder and that the mental disorder causes him to commit sexually violent offenses.
I know, but you still have to have a conviction, no matter
you
what
do.
You do.
That's
you've
right.
You've got to have a conviction, and you've got to choose what the conviction is.
Well, I'm not sure we do. That was my point to Justice Process.
I understand that.
That's point. One way to plead the petition is to designate a particular sexually violent offense. But under notice pleading, I think the only thing the statute requires is that the state allege that he has been convicted of a sexually violent offense without designating which one it was.
This one designated 2007, Winnebago County. Respondent Joseph Spaeth has been convicted of a sexually violent offense, specifically on or about July 3, 2007, in Winnebago County. He was convicted of 4 counts of child enticement. And that is the only one that is here. And you say he's within 90 days of release in this. And I don't see any reference to the old one, but I'm only on page.
There isn't one.
There isn't one.
I'll save you the time.
That's
but
right.
Here's the point that I'm trying to make. The paragraph that you read could, I think, comply with the statute by inserting a period after Mr. Spaeth has been convicted of a sexually violent offense and delete all the rest.
Yeah,
and
but
under,
you know what?
And
you
under,
didn't. That isn't what the petition
I understand
says.
It, which okay. is why I said the answer to Justice Prosser's question depends on how the petition was pled. In this case, the way it was pled requires an amendment. But
okay.
I don't think it necessarily would have required one had the state either alleged Mr. Spaeth has been convicted of a sexually violent offense, period, without designating what one, leaving that under notice pleading for discovery, or Mr. Spaeth has been convicted of a sexually violent offense in 1992 and a sexually violent offense in 2006. So what we have here was a pleading problem, not a problem of whether or not the state could prove the underlying criteria for commitment. I see my red lights on. So.
Thank you very much, counsel. Shall we fight? Is it fight, counsel? Assistant State Public Defender representing Joseph J. Spaeth. Now, Mr. Spaeth is where? Exactly.
Mr. Spaeth is currently at Sandridge.
So he is institutionalized under 980.
That's
is that
correct.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Has he had a probable cause hearing?
No, he has not.
So the fact that there's a petition filed against him is enough to institutionalize him?
It has, Your Honor. And that sort of gets to part of why we're here, is the petition itself matters. The legislature designed an orderly process for petitioning for 980 commitment, which sharply restricts who can be subject to commitment proceedings. This case is about the integrity of that process. Under 980.021M, and that's really what we're looking at here. We're not looking at the old 2AG. We're looking at 1M. A petition has to be filed before release or discharge. Now, if you read that in isolation, it means nothing, or it could mean anything. It could mean release from a hospital. So you have to read it in context. And in context, it's clearly referring to release or discharge from custody related to the offense underlying the petition. And you get that from reading, beginning with 980.01, defining the sexually violent offense in a sexually violent person as someone who has been convicted of that offense. 980.015, that goes to the DOCs providing notice when someone is reaching the end of their sexually violent offense sentence, and then on to the other subsections of 980.02, in addition to the filing requirement in 1M, the requirement that they plead with particularity the basis for believing that somebody is a sexually violent person. Here, the petition was filed in 2010, and that was more than 2 years after Mr. Spaeth had completely discharged from the 1992 offense. So there's no question, in 2010, the state could not have filed a petition based on the 1992 case. So it cannot do now what it couldn't do then by amendment, simply because between then and now it filed a petition based on a conviction that no longer exists. And we brought up in the brief that this just isn't, 980 is an extraordinary manifestation of government power, and it's not a place where the state gets to be creative. In the commitment of buyers case, this court looked at a filing requirement, and that's the requirement that the DA not be allowed to file a 980 petition unless the DOC has first recommended filing, the DOJ passes on that. In that case, the state tried to get around that rule. They made some creative arguments, but in the end, this court held the state to the statutory process, and it ordered the petition dismissed. Similarly, in the commitment of Thomas case in the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals was looking at a petition that was filed just days within the subject's release from DOC custody, and while he was still in custody on an earlier 980 petition. The DA tried to make some creative arguments to get around the custody requirement, but again, the court held the state to the statutory process, and it ordered the petition dismissed. Now, I want to get a little bit, so it seems like there was some interest here in talking about the whether the allegations really matter in this case. And could the state have said that simply he committed a sexually violent offense? I mean, the quick answer to that, I think, is no. We're not talking about straight notice pleading. This is a civil case, but there's a more specific provision that I believe the Chief Justice referenced that you must state with particularity the facts here. But I do think we agree to some extent, although for very different reasons, that the allegations themselves don't matter. And that is because even if the state had alleged in their petition in 2010 he was convicted of a sexually violent offense, or he was convicted of two sexually violent offenses, the problem we have is that it wouldn't be in compliance with 980.021M to use the 1992 case as the predicate offense. Because, again, you have to read that in light of the other statutes and of the general purpose of the custody requirement, which is to ensure both that the subject of the petition goes sort of directly from one sort of state custody into 980 proceedings, and also so that there's a real connection between the offense underlying the petition and the ultimate commitment trial.
Counselor, if you already have to be in custody when this is filed, how do you interpret 980.04 sub 1, which says that on the filing of a petition under 980.02, the court shall review the petition to determine whether to issue an order for detention of the person who's subject of the petition? I mean, if he's already in custody, what does the court need to issue any kind of an order to detain him for?
Well, because generally the 980 petition is filed soon before release. So I think in this case it was a matter of a week or two before release from DOC custody on that 2006 case. And so the court made a detention order, which immediately removed him from DOC custody and placed him in DHFF custody.
All right. Okay. Thank you. And let's see. When there's a filing, you have to hold a hearing under sub 2. Probable cause to believe it's sexually violent, right? So you think the court has to then know what the conviction was?
That's correct, Your Honor. And, you
the
know,
facts
and
of the conviction?
Yes, I think you absolutely need to know the conviction that you're talking about. And, you know, one thing that in this case, the case didn't make it that far down the process. And that's in part because everyone knew there was an active appeal going of the criminal case. And so, you know, neither party was trying to move the case forward on the basis of facts that that were capable of changing and even falling apart here. Now, one thing that
let me just double back. There are cases that indicate that the defendant doesn't have to be in prison only for a particular sexually violent a conviction. He's let out, and parole is revoked. So he's not in there he is in there, maybe you can say, for the original offense, but he's really in there because parole has been revoked. He's done something else. Or he's on more than one sentence. He may be on concurrent sentence for tax evasion and for a sexually violent act, right? And the cases seem to say that's close enough. And yet, and then there's Carpenter where they sentenced him, but then resentenced him for a longer time, and he's in custody. And the court says, under all those circumstances, he's in custody for the predicate offense. Is that right?
Yes.
So why can't you say here, you just extend those cases a little bit? Just stretch them a bit and say, you know, the conviction has been overturned, but what the state is saying, he's admitted to the act anyway. And that plus the prior conviction are good enough, close enough. What's the matter with that argument?
Well, first, I would disagree with the notion that those cases were about the court saying it's close enough. Those cases were interpreting the statutes. And so when you're looking at consecutive or concurrent sentences, they were looking at how sentences are calculated under the statute and what 980 was talking about in talking about release from a sentence. And so under the statutes, those simply counted as the cases from which you're released or discharged. And the earlier example you gave was even more clear, where you have someone who is, they have a sexually violent offense, they're revoked and they go back. They are serving a sentence on the sexually violent offense. You know, sometimes defendants like to say, oh, I'm just here on revocation. But they are there serving the sentence for the sexually violent offense. And so under the terms of the statute, those people are subject to 980 proceedings. The problem here is that under the terms of the statute, Mr. Spaeth can't be subject to 980 proceedings based on the 1992 case for which he discharged more than 2 years prior to 2010 when the petition here was filed. Essentially, the state says, well, you know, we got our foot in the door with this other case, so now we can bring in something that we couldn't have even filed when we filed this petition. And there's just nothing in the civil law that allows that in any other kind of case. There's nothing in the criminal law that allows that in any other kind of case. And again, we're talking about 980 commitment, which is potentially lifetime commitment of an individual. And the legislature has sharply restricted who can be subject to those proceedings.
Why didn't you get him out? You haven't had a probable cause hearing. His conviction has been overturned. Why is he being institutionalized now? I just don't understand that as a procedural matter. Maybe that has nothing to do with the case, and that's probably true. But nevertheless, curious mind wants to know.
I'm sorry that I can't illuminate that for you, except that the court stayed its order pending appeal, and by doing that, it kept him detained for the time being.
If you prevail, is he simply released from Sand Ridge?
That is correct, Your Honor. At this point, he is no longer serving a sentence on that 2006 case. He would be released from Sand Ridge, and I should stop there. It may be that he will get some assistance in finding housing and that sort of thing, but that assistance would not be coming from the DOC, if that's what you're asking.
Okay. And the state would have no way to deal, if assuming he's a dangerous person who has a mental condition, state has no remedy, is that right?
Well, I don't think you can assume that he is a dangerous person with a mental condition. He is presumed not to be a sexually violent person. He has never been proven to be a sexually violent person. He is a lifetime registrant, so the legislature had determined that was one way that the state could keep an eye on people who had been convicted of sexual offenses in the past. He may also be subject to GPS monitoring, but I'm sorry, I haven't looked into that specifically. But when someone reaches the end of their criminal sentence, generally, they are released, unless, you know, the 980 proceedings come forward properly according to the statute. And again, if he doesn't come within 980, then he gets to enjoy the freedom that anyone enjoys when they reach the end of their sentence.
But there are other commitment statutes, if he fits under them.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's
980 is not the only commitment statute.
There's Chapter 51. I mean, there are requirements for that as well, obviously. But, you know, we have no reason to speculate at this point about how Mr. Space will do on the outside. And again, he's presumed not to be a sexually violent person, and his only conviction for a sexually violent offense expired quite some time ago.
Apparently, I stepped in it when I asked Mr. Weinstein whether a person subject to 980 had the same rights as a criminal defendant. He said, oh, no, not anymore.
Unfortunately, I agree with him on that.
Is that part of the big revision of 980 at the same time?
I believe Attorney Weinstein would know better than me if it was from the 2006 amendments, but it's been in the last few years, Your Honor. They're still subject to, they still enjoy some of the rights of a criminal defendant, but they no longer enjoy all of those rights. Now, just one other thing I wanted to point out, since I'm not sure who had noted the subsection 3 of 980.02 in talking, where it does talk about the need to allege with particularity the facts, which, again, I think show this is not just a straight notice pleading civil case, which mentions that there can be people subject to Chapter 980 who are nearing the end of a sentence that's not for a sexually violent offense, but the state can allege they're sexually motivated. And I just want to take the opportunity in sort of bringing that up to note that if the state can file a petition, and in their view there's this snapshot rule, you look at the petition when filed, you don't look at it again, even if they are trying to amend the petition to do something differently, then theoretically there's no reason the state could not file a petition at the end of a burglary sentence and allege that it was sexually motivated. And then if that's determined not to be okay, you know, we can use this old sexually violent offense from a previous time. And I think I'm not saying the state would necessarily do that. But it certainly suggests that what they're talking about is something so fundamentally different than what we're used to in any kind of civil case or any kind of criminal case, where to the extent that you want to amend a complaint after the complaint is filed, not every amendment goes, because if it's something that could not have been filed at the time the complaint or the petition was filed, it can't move forward. So, yes, the court looks at competency and jurisdiction anytime it takes on a case, but it again has to look when the claims change, because the party who is the plaintiff or the petitioner in the case is changing that claim. They again have to look at their competency to decide the new issue as it's presented to them. And here, again, the new issue presented to them was the 1992 case as the predicate offense, which could never have served as the predicate offense for a petition filed in 2010.
Isn't that the basic dispute between you and the state? You say, well, the 1992 can't ever be the predicate offense here. And the state says, yes, it can.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's exactly the debate between
them. That is the heart of the debate. And, you know, the state wants this court to look at changes to the legislation in 2006. They want you to look at 2AG. And construe our argument as dependent on the 90-day rule But this argument has never depended on the 90-day rule. It's about 1M, which is a custody requirement that we agree is a condition precedent to filing a petition. It really defines who can be subject to a 980 petition. And that provision prevents exactly what the state is trying to do here.
Well, you are reading in shall be filed before the person is released or discharged from a offense of a sexual, before the person is released or discharged from a conviction for a sexually violent offense. You're reading in those words.
Right, and it's specifically from the sexually violent offense that's underlying the petition, because again, you have to look at all of these subsections together. And we're starting with the definition of a sexually violent person, which is someone convicted of a sexually violent offense. And then we go through the notice, the filing, the need to allege with particularity the offense underlying the petition. So this is all talking about the predicate offense. And I agree that predicate offense is not a word that appears in the statute, but it is a word that has been used for quite some time because it's a nice shorthand for what we're talking about. And it's exactly what this court found in Gilbert, because it is the most common sense and reasonable reading of this statute in context of the surrounding statutes. And it's in line with all of the cases previous to that. Well, if there are no further questions, I will end my time early. And thank you, and we would ask this court to affirm the circuit court's order dismissing this petition. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you. On a number of occasions, Mr. Spaeth argues about the terms of the statute. But the terms that Mr. Spaeth relies on have been deliberately removed by the legislature. So it's not the terms of the current statute upon which he relies, but the terms of the statute as it existed prior to 2006. Another point I'd like to make is Mr. Spaeth's counsel indicated we don't know how he would do, or we don't know whether or not he's a sexually violent person. Well, first of all, whether or not he's a sexually violent person is a matter of proof. And Mr. Spaeth's result doesn't allow the state to attempt to prove that he's currently dangerous and has a current mental disorder. And Mr. Spaeth must concede that he's been convicted of a sexually violent offense. So
that's the first one.
There are three elements. And Mr. Spaeth's result doesn't allow the state to even attempt proof at the other two elements. We do know how Mr. Spaeth reacted to being released when he was released on parole, which is one of the reasons we're here. Mr. Spaeth.
Also, my concern is that 980 results in many situations for a lifetime commitment. Now, sexually violent offense can have broad meaning. That is a charge and conviction of false imprisonment. As I recall, statutorily, even if it has nothing to do with sex, the false imprisonment has nothing to do with sex, is statutorily defined as a sexually violent offense. So now when you're dealing with high stakes, lifetime commitment, in a situation where the protections that initially existed in the statute when the constitutionality was first addressed in 1995, some of those protections have been either eroded or taken away. Now you are advancing that it can be for any statutorily violent offense. 20 years ago, this would have been, what, 22 years ago? And you don't have to be in, you can be in custody for possession of marijuana. Now, there's just some reaction. As a judge who's sat on cases and been part of this civil system and criminal system, that this seems, and I'm going to use a fancy legal term, awfully loosey-goosey, given the high stakes of lifetime commitment. This person has been committed for years now without a hearing. And this is all okay. This is the system that affords and protects constitutional rights. There's something amiss with this looseness, and you're now talking about notice pleading. Any offense in the past 22 years ago, even if it's not sexually related, as long as it's statutorily defined, and on any offense, operating after revocation, their defense. So can you respond to, you know, tell me all's right and everything's okay?
Well, we're only talking about a pleading requirement. None of those things would go to proof of whether or not the person was sexually violent. I also, not any offense can be alleged to be sexually violent because it's sexually motivated. It has to be one of the ones enumerated in 980.01.6b. Now, I haven't dealt with all of those, and I'm not sure whether or not intimidation or
false imprisonment. Dissent in that.
I don't think false imprisonment is in 942.25, 948.02, 948.025, 948.06, or 948.07. And those are the only ones for which you don't have to prove sexual motivation. Also, sub 3, I would disagree go ahead.
Never mind. Please.
I would disagree that the particularity requirement has to do with anything more than the fact that this person is sexually violent under the definition of a sexually violent person. That's what it says. It says, shall plead with the essential facts to establish probable cause to believe the person is a sexually violent person. Well, that goes to whether or not they have a sexually violent offense, they have a mental disorder, and they're dangerous because of the mental disorder.
Counsel, I'm going through the record here, and I'm just trying to, I want to make sure I've got the facts right. But back in 92, he was convicted of a sexual assault and sentenced. Then he was released on parole, and that's when the events allegedly occurred that led up to the interview with the agent and the 06 charges, right?
That's correct.
The 06 charges that were the charges referenced in the 980 petition were charges that charged him as a persistent repeater, thus carrying the life sentence, right?
I believe so, but he ended up pleading to lesser.
Okay.
Enticement.
But didn't he receive a sentence of life?
I don't believe so, but I don't know for sure what the sentence was. 5 years?
He was revoked on his 92 sentence when the allegations of 06 came up, when he had his interview.
That's correct.
Then he had to serve the remainder of that sentence and was released sometime in 2008.
He was discharged sometime in 2008. He wasn't released.
Discharged from that 92 sentence.
Right.
But at that time in 2008, had he already been sentenced on the 2006
I believe he had, but there was a problem with the information to the jury during jury deliberations, which caused the circuit court to order a new trial. And then he pled to reduce charges as a result of that. So the conviction that came before this court.
I'm looking at the previous judgment of conviction from, I think, Judge Carver that gives him four life sentences that are concurrent to any other sentence that he's serving, and that's in 07.
Those were vacated on post-conviction motion.
What was the date of the vacation of that?
I don't know, but the new convictions were in 2009.
And then you filed this in 10. The 980 petition.
Right. What happened was that he was.
Was he charged as a repeater in the 980 in the new?
I'm not that familiar with the criminal case.
Because if he were charged as a repeater, that would have to reference the 92 convictions.
Well, that's true, and it was charged, but I'm not sure it was part of the plea. I don't know.
Okay, well, that seems like it'd be somewhat important if we're talking about putting someone on notice as to whether the 92 convictions are in play here, right?
Well, I don't think the statute requires.
I know you don't, but even if it did, don't you think that'd be something that we ought to at least know what the right answer
is? Not as a matter of pleading, that as a matter of proof it might, yeah. But that's part of the problem here, it seems to me. What we're doing is, or what Mr. Spaeth would have the court do, is talk about what the legislature requires to plead the case and transform that into something as a matter of proof.
I understand what you're saying, but it may be actually part of the pleadings if the 92 offense is part of the 06 offense.
Why? I'm not following, but...
If he's charged as a persistent repeater, and the reason why you're charged as a repeater is because of a 92 offense, then they're on notice that's part of this petition.
Well, if you're talking about what the evidence is at trial...
No, evidence, I'm not.
Well...
That's different. If you're talking about you're convicted of this, and this conviction contains within it the 92 conviction... But we don't know that, because what I have in this record relates to something that apparently was four life sentences that were overturned, I guess. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think your question, Counselor, goes to whether there really is a need to amend. That's what her question goes to, because if you pull in the earlier conviction into what was in the petition that was filed, which everybody agrees the day it was filed, it was okay. If it pulled in that earlier conviction on that day, there isn't a need to amend.
That's right.
Okay. So
and
that's what her question
And that's exactly what I meant by saying when I answered Justice Proster's question to say, does the petition need to be amended depends on how it was pled to begin with.
But even if it was pled in regard to the later conviction, okay, if that later conviction is grounded in a repeater allegation, then... What Justice Ziegler is asking you is, doesn't that bring in the earlier offense? So it's already part of that, and there's no need to amend. I think that's where the question is.
Well, I hadn't really thought about that, so.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
fine.
These are complicated cases.
You have two problems. One, you don't know that there was a repeater, so that's totally hypothetical.
I don't know whether that was part of the new convictions.
Number two, no matter how you slice it, you come back to the problem that whole proceeding has been vacated. So even if he was charged as a repeater, that is all gone. And your whole premise here is based, your pleading is terrific, because on the day you filed it, it was correct. But you also know that you cannot prove that, and you have to prove it.
No, I don't have to prove it, and that's the key.
Okay.
And the reason I don't have to prove it is because 04 or 05 now requires the state only to prove that the person is a sexually violent person. And that is not keyed on that 2006 or 2009 conviction. It's any sexually violent offense. That's what the problem is, in my view, is that we're taking a requirement that's a pleading requirement and we're reading it into sub 3 saying the state has to prove that. It doesn't. The state only has to prove at trial that he has been convicted of a sexually violent offense.
Any offense at any time.
Any sexually violent offense.
But that,
not any offense any time, but any sexually violent.
Right, and you'd have to prove the 1993 offense here.
We could.
Well, you don't have any other sexually violent offense means somebody has been convicted.
Well, we
and
have,
that's the only conviction
we do. We have a
have.
Conviction from 1992.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a very interesting argument and a very interesting case on yet another Chapter 980, 12 AP 2170, State versus Joseph J. Spaeth. That concludes our argument. And the court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear the third case today.